Every spring, way up in the high country, the Wasatch Range and the Wind Rivers and the Rocky Mountains and the peaks in the mountains of Arizona and New Mexico, the snow melts and flows into creeks, which flow into rivers like the Gunnison and the Green and the Dirty Devil and the San Juan and the Gila River, and they all flow and give their life's blood to the Colorado River, so named because of its red color of all the sediment that just scours out of the six states of its drainage. And after the Colorado River leaves its masterpiece of the Grand Canyon, it heads south towards the Sierra Cortez, through the Mojave and the Yuma deserts. And historical records talk about this lower stretch of the Colorado River as this rich ribbon of green life, filled with forests of Palo Verde trees and cottonwood trees and mesquite groves, and filled with beaver and thousands of birds and jaguars and deer. Apparently, it was quite a sight to behold. And when the white man first came to the Colorado River, they started cutting those trees down and using them for fuel for their steamboats. And then they started building dams on the Colorado River. And the first dam that was ever built on the Colorado was a dam called Laguna Dam, and it was just north of Yuma, Arizona. And 6 months after it was built, it was totally filled in with sediment. Didn't last very long. And behind the dam now is what they call Mitre Lake, and it's not really much of a lake at all. It's just kind of a flat marshy area filled with channels and islands. And it was in this area in the early 80s that biologists thought they would try and put a little bit of shine back into that drainage by releasing Harris's hawks into that area. And Harris's hawks are really cool birds. They're a large chocolate brown raptor with chestnut shoulders and bold white bands on a black tail. They're gregarious. They hang out in family groups and they hunt cooperative. They're really fabulous hawks. And myself and my field partner at the time, John Vall, we were lucky enough to go down there several seasons and work with these birds. And so we would go down there in the late summer and early fall to work with these birds down there near Yuma. Now, if you've never been to Yuma in the summertime, it's hot, okay? It's triple digits hot, and my white 63 Rambler classic sedan had no air conditioning, and it had a black steel dashboard. And I quickly learned that I could put frozen burritos on there in the midday, and they would be heated up, and they'd be tasty and good to eat. And I was eating one of these dashboard burritos sitting outside of the BLM warehouse in Yuma, Arizona. And John came out carrying a large box and an odd look on his face. And he put the box in the car, and he sat down next to me. He said, "Well, that's it." He goes, "No more hawk food from the BLM. I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Well, the government, federal government, shut down." I said, "Federal government doesn't shut down." He's like, "I don't know. There's some budget thing in Washington, and they're shutting down." Little did I know, this was the first of many experiences I would have of the federal government shutting down. I said, "Well, what does that mean?" He goes, "Well, it means that we can't get any more hawk food from the BLM. I said, "Well, what are we going to do?" He goes, "Plan B." And plan B was for us to find our own food for these hawks. Now, we had 17 hawks that we were going to be releasing the following day. And we would have to feed them for at least 3 more weeks before they learned to hunt on their own. And 17 hawks can eat a lot. And so our plan B was to find food somehow, all right? And it always seemed like it was kind of a challenge to find food. I mean, the BLM provided us with frozen jackrabbits, frozen quail, and chickens, and we would butcher those up to feed them to the hawks. And there was one time they called up and they said, "Hey, we have these baby chickens. You want baby chickens?" We're like, "Hey, we'll take anything. We can use any kind of food." Well, when they said baby chickens, I was thinking, like, baby chickens. I wasn't thinking baby chickens, like 2-day-old chicks is what they were. Little fuzzy yellow chicks, 2 days old. And we got there and he has this box of 500 frozen baby chicks. And I get this box and, you know, you look in there and you're like, oh, they're fuzzy, you know? And so we tried feeding them to the hawks, and the hawks just kind of looked at them like, what? You know, they played with them, but they wouldn't eat them. And so I had a box of frozen baby chicks, 500 chicks. What am I going to do with these things? And so what I ended up doing is, before we go out on patrol on the desert dirt roads, I just get a bucket and put a bunch of baby chicks in there. And as I'd be driving on the dirt road, I just grab a handful and out the window they go. I figured coyotes would probably eat them. There'd be treats for them, raccoons, ants. I mean, it was biomass for the desert, okay? I just figured something's going to eat them. They didn't go to waste. So back to our situation at hand. We had to get food for these hawks, okay? And you can't just go get Purina hawk chow, okay? Because when you deal with predators, animals die, and you need animals, okay? And so we decided we'd go after pigeons, and we found this one place in Yuma that was great, and it was this building, large building on Yuma, where lots of pigeons were, and the guy let us trap pigeons up there on the roof. But after a while, he's like, no, I don't want you guys going up there trapping the pigeons. That's their home. Leave them alone. But it was like that was like the gold mine of pigeons in Yuma. And so we had to resort to going in there in the middle of the night and parking the government rig and then climbing up on the roof and grabbing the fire escape and climbing up the fire escape to the roof, getting the pigeons, reset the traps, and go back out. And that worked for a while until we got up there and our trap was gone and a nasty note was there saying, don't ever come back. And if you do, they threatened us with bodily harm. So we're like, okay, we got to find another place to trap pigeons. So we went to Blythe, which is north of Yuma. And we got to Blythe, and we were watching the pigeons, where they're going, and they're all going to this one particular building, which ended up being the Blythe Movie Theater. And so we went up to the theater, we knocked on the door, and this old, wizened gentleman came out, and dressed in a suit with a bow tie. It looks like he had been there since the 50s, okay? And he comes, and he goes, can I help you, gentlemen? We said, yeah, we wonder if we could trap pigeons on your roof because we're going to be using them for hawks. And he looked at us. He said, you want to trap pigeons on the roof of my building? And we're like, yeah, we're releasing these really cool hawks back into the wild. And originally we were getting food from the federal government, but it shut down. And we went on and I explained the whole thing. And he looked at us he said, and he kind of just blinked and he said, you want to trap pigeons on the roof of my building? And you do this for free? When can you start? And we're like, yeah, great. Okay. We're pretty excited about this. Now, I looked over at John, though, but John had this look of, I could tell he was angry. And later I realized he was angry at himself for failing to realize the income potential of pigeon eradication, okay? Years later, John actually had a job of getting rid of coots, these waterfowl, at playing communities in Southern California, where they had these playing communities with lakes and grassy areas and golf courses. And people love seeing birds walking around there. They really like them, but they don't really like the squishy surprises they leave behind. And so they paid him to relocate the coots. And it all went well until friends of the coots found out that he was relocating them to the bellies of hawks and falcons, and then they kind of shut him down. So back to our situation. The guy said we could trap pigeons on his roof. So we went and built some pigeon traps. And basically they're 2x2 structures with a lid on the top that made out of chicken wire so that we could get the pigeons. And then there was a funnel on one side. So you put bird seed in there and then run a little bird seed in the funnel, and they would go inside the funnel, eat the bird seed, and then they couldn't come out. They were trapped in there. So we went back to the theater, and the old guy took us up the stairs, and we got to the ladder that led to the attic that would take us to the roof. And when we got up the ladder and entered the attic, we realized the old gentleman's dilemma. Because what had happened is the roof hatch for the attic that went onto the roof had broken. And so there was light streaming in from outside. It was open to the elements. And it illuminated the scene out of Alfred Hitchcock's movie, The Birds. There were scores of pigeons inside the attic, cooing, strutting, preening, flapping, squabs off in the corner, dead pigeons lying around. And as we stood up to walk into this attic, the pigeons just went, they all took off. And we heard this, and we turned around, and the theater guy, he was gone. He wanted no part of this. And I'm holding my shirt over my mouth. I'm telling John, it's like, man, we need dust masks before we come back in here. Because there's like feathers, and there's guano all over the place. And John's like, yeah, that, and we are never seeing a movie in this theater ever. And he pointed down at the floor beneath us, the ceiling of the theater. And the boards originally, I'm sure, had been well-formed and fit together, but now there were cracks and gaps, and you could see the seats down below. So who knew what was raining down into that? I said, it's a good thing it's dark when people come in there and sit down, right? He's like, let's just get out of here. This place gives me the creeps. So we set a trap up there in the attic, and then we went onto the roof where there are even more pigeons, and we set a trap up there. The next day, we left. We came back with our masks, and we entered the attic. Again, the pigeons, they all try and take off, except there's this one knot of birds that's like trying to get airborne, but they can't. And we realize it's in our trap. But there's so many pigeons in the trap, it's lifting the trap off the ground. Up, and it happens like 2 or 3 times, and then the trap tips over because there was no bottom on it, and the pigeons all escaped. When we got to the roof, we were a little better prepared. We ran over, pinned the trap down, were able to get the pigeons out. And later, we realized you had to anchor the trap down so it wouldn't take off. So that's where we ended up getting all the food for the hawks. And we trapped easily over 100, hundreds of pigeons out of there. There were so many pigeons that provided food for the hawks for the next 3 weeks. So it worked out really well for the hawks. It worked out well for us that we didn't have to get food from the BLM. It worked out well for the theater owner, and we ended up fixing his roof hatch so that they wouldn't come in there once we were able to get all the pigeons out of there. We fixed that. And so, you know, plan B actually ended up being better than plan A. It was a win-win-win for everything all around, for theater, us, well, except for the pigeons. It wasn't so good for them, but thank you.